Hi, thank you so much for coming. I really appreciate it. We're going to get started with our panel discussion in just a moment. But before we do, I'd like to introduce Nancy Reyes from Parnassus, who will lead us in a little toast and then invite you to take your seats right away. Nancy, come on over.
Thank you very much. So just to briefly say thank you to everyone who's here today. I thought we should raise a glass and recognize ourselves as participants and individuals that are interested in what responsible investing can bring to the broader community, not just investors, but individuals, consumers, and people that are interested in identifying what ways sustainability can be promoted. Today we're going to talk about responsible investing, and PRI has put out a great piece. I know everyone's been congregating around the bar, but over on this table as well, there's some material from the sponsors, Parnassus being one. We have been a signatory of the PRI for many years and since then have seen it grow. And so we have an incredible panel today, and Parnassus is honored to be a part of it. So a quick toast, and thanks to everyone. I'm looking forward to a great evening. Cheers.
I was 10, 11, 12, I don't remember, in line for the movies. And there were two guys in line in front of us, like three or four people in front of us, holding hands. And my mother pulled me to her, not my siblings, just me, and looked at my father and said, "They're weird," which just made me look at those guys. And I went, "Oh, now I get it. I'm weird like they're weird." And I looked at them and I thought, they look happy. They look like they're in love. I'll be fine.
Inform brings you incredible stories.
I left 2 days before the revolution. It killed me so hard.
James has never experienced the taste of fruits that haven't been attacked by pesticides, just like he's never experienced a neighborhood that hasn't been attacked by bullets. Some things just go hand in hand.
And there was a rally that I had to cover. So when Patty Poblete, who was the editor at the time, who assigned me to cover it, what wasn't I supposed to tell her? Like, I'm undocumented and I can't cover this rally? So I went ahead and covered it. I was so scared when I was at the Washington Post that they were going to keep assigning me these immigration stories because my name is Jose.
People say what's on their mind.
I think that it is a cardinal sin to lie to the American people about war.
Partisanship is a version of narcissism.
In downtown San Francisco, the Commonwealth Clubs and Forum curates events that bring you face-to-face with the world's changemakers.
One-third of the wage gains that women have made since the 1960s were made as a result of the birth control pill.
Twitter is a technology that I don't think we've seen before in this world.
Since 1903, the most innovative leaders have come to the Commonwealth Club to share their vision.
Sharing cars, sharing their homes, sharing. A shared dream, a shareable American dream. That could work.
You each can play a role in helping us chart a better future.
Housing and health and education and policy all live close to the surface in us when our children are murdered. It's all the same story.
We bring together the visionaries shaping the emerging trends in technology.
It was a combination of instant and telegram. It was the idea that you could take a moment in time and you could capture it and you could just send it out and broadcast it with the entire world.
I just threw the site together in about a week when I was at school.
Oh, great.
We've got angels, we've got incubators, we've got accelerators, we've got seed funds, we've got crowdfunding.
We eat. We drink.
One of our first dates ever, we pickled like 100 pounds of herring and made 300 pounds of sauerkraut.
Yay!
We never shy away.
75% of the people of this country want universal health care and expect it. And damn it, let's go!
Concentrated, deep, slow, loving, tender, passionate. Sex.
Whether you want to be on the cusp of current events or feast on pop culture.
You know, it was my time to just make the movies that I wanted to make.
I should have a great time writing. I should write a book that is as fun as any party I'd be skipping.
Inform events are fun and action-packed.
I have an anthropology scarf that does that twisty thing, so...
Come feed your mind and soul and celebrate the future with Inform.
I love San Francisco, and every time I come back here, I remember that this is the only city in America that has magic in it.
good evening and welcome to tonight's event with the Commonwealth Clubs in Forum, $45 trillion can't be wrong, a responsible investment networking event. I'm Whitney Rauschenbach, head of ESG marketing for the Americas at MSCI, a global leading provider of investment decision support tools to investors. Over 800 asset owners, asset managers, and other clients use our environmental, social, and governance research and analysis to meet their responsible investing goals. We collaborate with the PRI on many levels. MSCI is a signatory to the PRI, similar to Parnassus, and we work directly with PRI signatories to help them integrate ESG factors into their investment decisions. As we will likely hear more from our panel tonight, ESG factors are increasingly viewed by large financial institutions through a financial rather than a values lens. We are thrilled at MSCI ESG Research to be a sponsor of this event and to contribute to the conversation on the growing momentum of responsible investing in the U.S. As you know, tonight is part social and networking and part panel discussion. I'm happy to introduce you now to the 30-minute panel, which will be followed by 10 minutes of questions. I want to wish you all a very happy holiday season, and I'm now going to pass it off to our moderator, Anna. Thank you.
I'm Anna Mock. I'm a partner at Deloitte & Touche LLP here in the city, and also I have the privilege for the last few years of being the board chair for the Board of Governors for the Commonwealth Club. I'm so thrilled to see actually everyone braving the rain. I was coming from Palo Alto. I know traffic was horrendous, both coming into the city and into the city. So thank you all for coming this evening. This evening's event is one of our Inform programs. For those of you that are new to the club or new to Inform, we like to consider the Inform really the club's innovation lab. We do a lot of cutting-edge things. We really experiment. And we also really bring very interesting speakers that maybe are not, that come at the topic from really different perspectives. The video you just saw hopefully gives you a pretty good taste of what we do here at the club and what Inform is. The Inform, I always say, is it's really about culture and curiosity. And so I'm glad all of you are here really at this Inform event. It's really a chance to connect with world leaders, really get, again, I mentioned being amongst forethought leaders, and just meet a range of folks. And I think that's what makes the Bay Area interesting, is there's so many of us from such different backgrounds. We wouldn't be able to host fantastic events like this evening and bring important discussions to the public if it weren't for our members and our sponsors. So I do want to take a moment on behalf of the Commonwealth Club to thank tonight's sponsors, and they are UNPRI, MSCI, Parnassus Investments, and Industry Capital. So thank you, our sponsors, for this evening. If you'd like to become a member, and I know we have members and also guests of members, a sponsor, a supporter in any way, please do talk to our great guest services team that will be at the post-networking event. Many of you may not be aware, but we actually host almost 500 events a year. That's amazing. That's over, you know, greater than one a day. And upcoming, we actually have our annual dinner on April 2nd. It's one of our very special programs. And this year, we actually have some very important honorees, including Sir Michael Moritz, who's the chairman of Sequoia Capital, Jennifer Siebel Newsom, founder of the Representation Project, and John Watson, chairman and CEO of the Chevron Corporation. I think our honorees reflect really what the club's about, right? The broad background they're from. So I'd welcome to all of you joining me to really support and invest in the club, coming to the dinner. We have an after party this year. That's something new to our annual dinner. It's going to be on April 2nd, so more to come on that. Tonight, we're really here to talk about investing and about the principles and markets for social investment. I'm really pleased that we have such a distinguished panel with us tonight. I'm not going to go over their bios in detail. They were posted on the website, but I will introduce them to you so you can put a name with a face. Immediately to my right is Preston Dodd, VP at Bernstein Capital Wealth Management and advisory council member of the SASB. And then next to him is Michelle Itkins, managing director at BlackRock. And then to her right is Lloyd Kurtz, chief investment officer for Nelson Capital. And then last but not least is Gloria Neldum, who is actually coming from Southern California, so she had the longest way to travel, and she's the CEO and chairman of TriLink Global, We had a bit of a prep in advance, and they will be very lively as panelists and have much to share and much to say. So our goal is what they have to share and say will be really a fodder for you as we go into the networking event afterwards. So let's get started. We have a range of folks in the audience, so we thought it makes sense to really level set on some of the definition and jargon you're hearing. So I'd ask each of the panelists to just give us their 30-second definition of what is responsible investing.
Oh, I'll start.
Start with Gloria.
Sure. Oh, wow. Okay, so I think responsible investing actually is the overarching umbrella for all kinds of other jargon that you will hear, basically encompassing things like ESG, so environmental, social, and governance screening, whether it's positive or negative screening. It also encompasses impact investing, which does have a slightly different definition because it's looking at a different angle of the market. But basically, if you think about impact investing, it's all about capital formation and capital support for companies, basically, right? And all along that spectrum, there are different ways of holding companies accountable from beyond an investment perspective. So responsible investing, I think, covers, that's my own view, our company's view, covers the entire spectrum. And so it's basically holding companies accountable to practices and policies of what they do, whatever their company's vision is.
Lloyd?
Yeah, I think that's a great starting point. And one of the challenges that we have is it's sort of the same problem you have in nature, right? There's beetles, right? Everyone knows what a beetle is. But there's big differences, and the differences matter a lot to the beetles. And so we have a lot of different terms. I've got a list somewhere of about 50 different terms I've heard over the years: guideline investing, green investing, stakeholder investing, socially aware. All of these things are answering one question. Should we take something into account when we allocate capital beyond conventional risk and reward parameters? Should we be looking at something beyond our selfish economic opportunity? In the old days, that was the whole debate. If we had a panel like this, should there be such a thing as social investing? And it's tough to get someone to take the other side anymore. Post-financial crisis, I think there was a sea change in even people who believed very strongly, as I do, in the power of markets to do good, just questioned whether that was the complete solution. And so today we're not arguing about should there be some kind of social investing. I think it's a great container term, if we can call it that. And now we're arguing or discussing what are the different ways that you can do it. How can you bring values and ethics and all these things we've been told since we were children matter, right? Ethics matters, values matters, integrity matters. Okay, in my portfolio? No, not there. Not in your stock portfolio. So we've gotten past that. I think everyone understands these things matter and they matter everywhere. So now how are they going to matter?
Sure. The only thing I would add to that is that the lens through which we look at it is, are these companies being well led and well managed and in a way that is sustainable, both in terms of their economic and social, environmental and social impact and their economic performance, so that you have a viable economic system over time? Because most of the clients that we invest for are investing for the long term. They're saving for their pension, they're saving for their kids' college education, and it doesn't benefit them in any way to make quick profits in the next couple of quarters that are going to impair a company or a whole sector's ability to generate those same profits, those jobs, the whole sort of spectrum of economic activity in 1 or 2 or 5 years' time. So are we enabling a sustainable economy through our investment strategies? And that isn't to exclude any particular part of the economy, it's to ensure that all companies we invest in are being well-led and well-managed over time.
And I guess I add the benefit of, or the challenge going last, is that a lot of these good points have been covered. I think that I would add, though, that there's some other trends, macro trends, that are benefiting us as we think about PRI, principles of responsible investing, or it could be sustainability, governance issues, where there's more transparency now, I think. The ability to get information is greater. So I think that we can take the next level as we work with individuals and clients and align with their values, and so that there's alignment around The types of companies that they're investing in, so that on one hand they have certain types of beliefs, on the other hand they, in the past, frankly may not have known everything that was happening, and I think that's part of an ongoing effort. But I think today there is more transparency, there's more awareness, and I think that bifurcation will go away, and I think that shareholders will be asking more questions, and I think, to Michelle's point, in the long run, in terms of good governance, those are questions that should be asked, because in the long run those are better use of resources, and we'll talk about that tonight. But I think it becomes an umbrella term that allows a starting point for a good conversation.
So you can see, I mean, it's really evolving, right? In terms of the definition, each of our panelists will like come at that definition with a slightly different angle. And we were talking about it's probably less important what is the exact definition, but that understanding that there is a spectrum of that, and that each of us can interpret it and understand what we want. So there's a lot of talk about this 45 trillion. Number? What is that? I mean, why this 45 trillion bogey, and what are the implications of that?
Justin? If you look at different numbers and figures out there in publicly traded markets in the developed world, numbers, I mean, these are huge numbers, they're staggering numbers, but if we could say roughly 80 trillion of market capitalization in those markets around the world. And so 45 trillion as a number becomes significant in many ways. And I don't think you have to be at half to have critical mass. I think that momentum will, can start at much lower percentages. I think that the 45 trillion, the first stage of that has typically been what has been called negative screens. I don't want tobacco stocks necessarily, or I don't want oil, or I don't want companies with exposure in certain countries, those types of things. And I think that was a starting point, and I think and the 45 trillion can take that into account. Now I think the next phase of this will be how do we get to the point of more proactivity? So we're not negatively screening, but we're starting to say how do we encourage certain types of behaviors, both from the perspective of awareness by shareholders, but also from a bottoms-up type of conversation, so that those that are interacting with their capital through, it may be directly through mutual funds, it may be their own investments, or it may be as a shareholder speaking to companies, that those behaviors proactively, I care about this, I want to see these types of things, or it said another way, that that those behaviors are being encouraged, because as consumers we have choices and we can start to express those through the types of companies that we not only invest in but that we purchase from.
Anything to add, Michelle?
I would say the 45 trillion is firstly a made-up number, and secondly,
let's get to the hard facts.
It's largely irrelevant, and why I think it's a made-up number is it's everyone's best guess as to what is being allocated to this type of investing. And why I think it's irrelevant is it doesn't matter if you go into a company and say, "Hello, we're an investor. There's $45 trillion invested in a responsible way in the economy, and for that reason, we want you to change." Because what will change a company is the exact investors in it telling that company what their expectations are of how it's led, how it's managed, how it impacts more broadly the economy and society. The weight of money is an investment manager's way of thinking of the world. And I mean, for people who are not asset managers or sort of professional investors in this room, do you really care that it's $45 trillion? Does that mean anything to you other than it's just a lot of money? I don't think it changes opinion. I think it's an investor's perspective on how you make a point, which is we've got more money than you have.
I do think it wraps back on your definitional question as well. I think there's a lot of money historically that's been sensitive to these things that was never classified as socially responsible. John Templeton, the great value investor, never owned a tobacco stock. So is he a socially responsible investor? Don't count him. We don't get to count his track record. I'd like to when we do in performance. But I think some type of social investing is pervasive behavior. When I talk with a client at all about it, they'll say, "Oh, I'm not interested in it." You say, "Okay, so Sudan companies are okay, tobacco." No, not those. You know, and so even clients who will say they don't have an interest, when you actually start to talk with them about it, often express an interest. And I think the constraint on the size of the industry is not demand. I think it's supply. I don't think we've created enough products that meet people's diverse needs to fully meet the demand that's out there. That's why I think it's such an exciting industry.
Yeah. Right. Gloria, you started a company really focused on this. So the question is, and we'll also ask other panelists, why now? I mean, Lloyd mentioned we've been ethical for a while. You gave the example of other investors. But why now? Why all this buzz all of a sudden? It seems to be the rage in the markets around responsible investing.
Oh, no, go ahead. I do think, so I've been investing as a professional investor for over 35 years. And I think that a number of us really believed that ethical, responsible companies would present lower risk and potentially outperform those that don't, like if you take those things into consideration. So that's been around for a long time. I think the big drivers of the trends now, one is the financial crisis. The global financial crisis really brought a lot of awareness to this idea of ethics. And I think it sort of basically said to people, wow, not everybody's ethical. And so some of us could look at it and go, yeah, you should have known that before. But I think that was probably the biggest driver of the general population waking up and saying, this is important. I think that the second reason is many of you in here, how many of you consider yourself millennials? There's quite a few I see, right? Probably half the crowd. And I would say that's the second big driver of this is that the next generation actually does care about the products they buy, the jobs they take, the companies that they, you know, they work for, that they work with, and the investments they make. And I think that you know, this generation just is more focused on the fact that we have limited resources, the fact that, you know, this can't go on forever this way. So in my view, those are the two big things that are driving the awareness towards it.
Lloyd, did you want to add to that?
I think that's exactly it. There was an old line. My old boss, Steven Leidenberg, quoted Max Planck to me a couple years ago. He said, Planck said, physics advances funeral by funeral. And the fact is, as people get set in their ways, you get to a point where you figure you've got it pretty well figured out and you're not going to change your views. I think that's why, you know, youth is a very powerful thing. And in our industry, I think the financial crisis accelerated some of that turnover. People left the industry and other people elevated. And there's an openness and an integration that we didn't see 10 years ago.
Yeah. I think there's another factor which gets to the point that you already made, Preston, about transparency, but it's the counter to transparency and something that SASB is so important in influencing is the ability to gather data and report it out now. Because there is a social media aspect of transparency around things like slave labor and so on, which would never have been known about otherwise in the past. But companies, a lot of companies have been doing a really good job on managing their environmental and social impacts, being good corporate citizens, if you will. They've just never reported it out. And the mechanisms are still very much in development. But as investors, we can only start taking things into account. We can measure and use to compare companies against one another. And this is a really important development in making this, if you like, a grown-up investment style, is bringing it onto the same footing as traditional mainstream investing, which is more purely around financial things. Before that, it was always a best guess or a sense about the quality of management, and it was nearly always in the negative. A terrible thing happens at a company, therefore we won't invest in it anymore. Or it was much more around values. We won't invest in tobacco or we won't invest in defense. Now it is much more across the board recognized that these are long-term financial drivers, and if we have the data to measure that, we can assess which companies are doing it well and which companies are doing it poorly, and therefore where the value gap is.
And I think that's an important point. Please.
No, I'll add a minute.
I do this with acronyms a lot, so the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board on SASB, of which I'm on the advisory council, in trying to create continuity and consistency in a material basis so that these things will be disclosed quarterly. There's a regular disclosure process happening by companies so that in 85 different industries, because I think this is also important, if you were to say waste in the oil industry or the pharmaceutical industry or consumer packaged good industry, it's going to mean slightly different things. So by industry, what do these types of things mean so that in some ways, hopefully, as tragic as what was happening in Bangladesh in terms of working conditions was, that we can start to look at more proactively in supply chain. How are workers being treated? What are the governance issues What are the resource usage issues that are disclosed materially so that outside investors can look? Because ironically, I mean, there is more transparency. There's so much data now, you can almost hide behind data. So how is it done in a way that's consistent? And that's a great point that Michelle brought up.
Lauren? So I was going to add, because I think this is a really important point in this whole thing, is that investors actually have the control, right? Because we have the money as investors, whether it's an individual investor or even a fund manager. But the problem was historically, and I think it is now starting to change, the problem was that we basically weren't influencing the behavior of the companies that we were investing in, whether it was private companies or public companies. We were rewarding behavior that was not taking those things into account. So you were talking about companies that were already doing it, but they weren't reporting it. Well, the reason they weren't reporting it was because it wasn't perceived that anybody valued it, right? Because the companies that got rewarded and got the money were the ones that were showing top-line revenue growth. And so it is, I mean, it's pretty simple, right? If you're getting rewarded for doing this and not doing this, then you're going to report out on these things. And I think that all of this is coming together to be, like, the transparency is really important. And I think investors now are more collectively saying, we actually do care about those things. And it will be, at the end of the day, it's the investors who have the control. So they have to, all of you, you have to be the ones to say, this behavior is not okay, right? And however then that gets reflected, it is what will start to change things over time. And I just want to say one quick thing. It was amazing to me when I was CEO of Deutsche Bank's Private Wealth Management Division for North America. I met with some of our largest clients in the U.S., and I would sit there and say to them, gosh, you put all this money in these philanthropic endeavors that are great things. You're trying to solve big problems. But I do want to point out that these investments in your investment portfolio are causing some of those problems. And I would, every single time, they would go, oh, yeah, but that's my investment. And I would go, really?
It's different.
I mean, like, it is.
People separate the two.
It's amazing. They do.
They don't matter.
Right. It's wild to me.
Yeah, speaking about
that. We have to change that. That's the point.
Speaking about the investor, the U.S. is used to being ahead, right? And we talked a little bit. Europe, on this topic, seems to be much ahead of us. Are we going to be just continuing lagging behind Europe? Or are we going to really be a leader here? And what are some drivers that could make us a leader compared to Europe or other parts of the world?
Let me just say, first of all, our sponsors are among the most innovative social investors in the world. Yeah. So I want to get that out of the way. And so we're not talking about anyone.
Yeah.
But I think European, it's a misnomer because you see funds like one of the Norwegian pension funds has a tobacco screen that would look very similar to what a lot of American funds do. You see very innovative, fully integrated ESG products optimized to the market. And USEI Share KLD ESG Select fund is a perfect example of something that's not a traditional screen. So I think it's a little too easy to say, the Europeans have it right, the Americans have it wrong. It's fun competitively always to kind of denounce the other continent. But there's innovation on both sides, and there's some really cool products everywhere.
I guess I'd also speak to generationally. This came up before, millennials, defined by a Deloitte study as those born after 1982. not me. But they talked to millennials, and the sample size was about 300 per country, so different countries around the world. And what was interesting is the primary purpose of business, as responded by the millennials, was to improve society ahead of profitability. And what was also interesting is then to start cutting it by country. And the U.S. is doing okay on that front in terms of generational. And I think that also if you then, that umbrella term that we talked about in the beginning, if you look at some of the impact investing or some of the innovations that are happening, I think there are things to learn culturally across the world. So in that way, I think part of this becomes the lens where the geography is. But I think also part of it is the lens of the age group that's looking at these issues. And so I think generationally, that's the strongest wave we have maybe right now, maybe a little bit more than geography itself now.
I think there's another reason that Europe is where it is right now today, and whether it lasts or not, I think is generational as much as anything. And that is, broadly speaking, as much as you can generalize across 26 member states of the European Union, they have a much more social democratic political starting point. And that means that companies are more aware from the get-go of their social contract, of their license to operate. And I think the market-oriented share price efficiency model in the US is quite different. They're just different. I'm not saying one is better, but I think that informs a lot of the difference right now. And certainly the public pension, the government-sponsored and corporate-sponsored pension plans in Europe have always been much more socially oriented than the U.S. ones. The U.S. ones, it's traditionally been the public plans, the municipal plans. And I think that is a big difference because from our perspective as a global investor and with a global client base, the sort of equivalents of JP Morgan, so the platform providers in Europe, all require us to be a signatory of UNPRI to get on their platforms. That is not true here. But that's because of client demand.
Right, exactly. And so what's funny is, so I agree with you that Europe is definitely ahead of us, but what Americans will do is what Americans always do, which is like nothing exists until we do it. And so basically, once it really gets going here, then we will say, oh, no, we're the drivers of this trend.
And we've always done it this way.
And we've always done it this way.
So we will definitely be making the impact. And Lloyd mentioned all the innovation going on, right, and the demographic shifts that we have, and that will be our advantage.
One big difference there is the European version is more institutional. The American version, you have a lot more happening at retail, happening with individuals. Mm-hmm. So you have that asymmetry as well.
Okay, we're going to go to live questions in about 5 minutes. So there are mics, I believe, set up. There'll be one mic set up. And so please, if you are interested in asking a live question, please queue up. And do make sure your question is quite brief because we want to give many members of the audience. So I'll come back to that, but start queuing up, please. So let's get into some examples. You know, we've talked more broadly about what this means. Can you share what some examples of either companies or asset managers or individuals that are really making an impact, right, that we would say is a best practice? Lloyd, do you want to go first?
Well, one recent one I wanted to call out because I think, you know, we're talking about a spectrum here. And at one end of the spectrum, how can we, most large institutions define risk as the deviation from an index. Jargon's tracking error. How much tracking error can we give up? If we start doing social things, however wonderful they might be, we're going to fail in our fiduciary duty if we're wildly away from our benchmark index. So Swedish pension fund AP4 recently worked with MSCI, which is an index provider sponsor tonight, and they worked out a trade-off where they would decarbonize their portfolios and accept a certain amount of variation relative to the benchmark. And with modern risk management tools, you can get fairly, it's not perfect, but you can put a pretty good band of error around how much variation you'll have. So some people would criticize that as light touch because it's one issue and they're not even doing a full screen on it. But what's great about it is it's a lot of money. I think it's $900 billion, a really large amount of money. And they're incorporating ESG within their risk budget to the degree that they can do it. They can bring environmental, social, and governance into their approach. They're doing so. So that would be one end of the spectrum. The full opposite end of the spectrum is Green Century Mutual Funds in the U.S. just have decided, you know, we're not going to own any fossil fuel stocks. The heck with tracking her. We're just not going to own them. It's wrong. They're contributing to climate change, and their clients are really pleased with that. So all along that spectrum, that's a whole variation of practice you can see.
Michelle, do you have an example, too?
One of the things that I think will really change the debate is when organizations invest their money, to sort of get to Gloria's point about some of the philanthropic investors, where they invest their money in line with their public policy statements. And so we were very encouraged and obviously the beneficiaries of a decision by the UN pension plan, the employees, the staff pension plan, to invest in an index product and to initiate an index product, which is an iShares product with BlackRock, and it's also a State Street product, that is investing in companies that are adapting to a low-carbon economy. And intellectually, this is a personal view, not a BlackRock view, but intellectually, I think that is superior to just divesting fossil fuels. Because as much as it might make you feel good morally to divest fossil fuels, if that's your view of the world, If you're going to do that, you need to divest all energy companies, all transportation companies, all construction companies, basically any manufacturing company, because every manufacturing process involves petrochemicals. Every tech company, because they use data warehouses that use energy that are derived from coal. I mean, it goes on and on and on. So I think if you have a strong moral stance, that's one thing. If you're really trying to change the way the economy works, divestment doesn't make a difference. The $50 billion that has been pledged to divest out of fossil fuels is a tiny portion of the $5 trillion that is the public part of the fossil fuel sector. 80% of fossil fuel companies are owned by governments and sovereign wealth funds. They don't care. I mean, the investor voice does not impact them because they're governments. And so I think carefully about how you want to achieve what you want to achieve and ensure that it matches up intellectually with the change you want to see in the world.
You know, and I think actually on this whole idea of fossil fuel divestment, it's such an important point because we've been asked, we make loans to private companies, right? These are small and mid-sized businesses in very select developing economies that are typically underdeveloped, right? So they are developing, but they're underdeveloped. And so if you've got a food processor that now needs to export and you want them, this is to your point, to completely divest of or not be in fossil fuels, you go, well, they're not as a company, but basically the way they transport everything is using fossil fuels. And you want to basically disadvantage this small company by saying, okay, you can't transport that way, even though the rest of the world does. And so I think it's all about incremental, and it's about really understanding how we change behavior and how we get companies to behave better.
And be pragmatic about it, right?
And be thematic about it. Absolutely.
Okay. We have a cue for the question, so we'll start with the first attendee. And again, keep the question short and one question only, please.
Okay, thank you. I'm Lincoln Payne. Lloyd, you couldn't answer that last question, Nelson Capital, huh? When she asked, you know, a company that's doing the good job, I couldn't say that.
So thank you for pointing that out.
Very recently, the G20 came up with new banking rules in which the banks that are considered too big to fail can use depositor money as a final guarantor of their value over and above taxpayers. And the new government funding bill in the United States has made that official in the United States, made that the law in the United States. This is historic. For the first time, the taxpayers are not on the line, but the depositors their money can be turned into capital in order to protect the banks against failure. This means that we don't have to take the too big to fail banks.
The question is,
what do you folks think SRI is likely to do in response to this? Do you think this is an SRI question, and do you think that there is a response? Thank you.
So is there a response to basically some of the recent acts?
I'll let Lloyd answer that. We don't invest in public securities. We're doing private company investing, so you're probably more informed.
Since my firm is owned by a bank, I should throw it to the other one.
Okay, the first question was a really tough question because two of our panelists are punting it. Michelle.
And I was going to say, I could Teflon that as well because we might be judged to be a SIFI soon if we're not careful. But I won't do that. What I will say is I think there are a few things around banking that investors have to think about carefully in relation to regulation. But the first thing I think that we need as investors to assess is the culture within a bank and whether it has really changed. Because all of these rules and all of these regulations won't prevent another crisis if the culture within these organizations does not accept that none of this money is their own, it's their clients' money, and that they are meant to be the prudent, trustworthy holders of that money and to invest it in a way that generates returns for those investors. What I think it means, if you have a deposit account, you need to make sure, look very carefully at the interest rate you're getting, does it reflect the risk you're now taking? And secondly, whether you think it's a bank that has a track record of being prudent and trustworthy and good with their clients' money.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. I'm Jim Hawley, St. Mary's College and True Value Labs in San Francisco. A question going back to the divestment issue. I've always had a notion that the divestment campaigns are really complex dances where people have different steps and perhaps different rhythms. And as you probably all know, Governor Brown yesterday is proposing to the legislature to have at least PERS and STRS divest from coal in particular, not all fossil fuels, but coal. And so I was curious about your reactions in terms of that as a strategy or a tactic in terms of the dance of a disinvestment and different firms and attitudes having different roles. Thank you.
I think it's cool that two of the panelists are working with social screens and two are not. So you can have impact. Once you implement divestment, you've given up your voice option. You can't complain because you don't own that stock anymore. Stanford has divested from coal stocks recently. So I think the dance you describe, the one thing we know from the studies is it doesn't move the stocks typically. There's a big study of the South Africa boycott, and they looked out high and low, and they could find no impact on the stock prices. Markets are big and liquid. The prices reflect the future economic opportunity. So we're not going to hurt them by crushing their stock. So it's really, to my mind, a political activity. It's a prop and a political, and it may be an effective prop. I think in the South Africa boycott, it was a useful tool, and it helped get additional leverage against that regime.
Okay. Next question.
So I was wondering, when it comes to socially responsible investing, do you ever take into consideration of the question of from whose perspective? By that, I mean it might be something, it might be socially responsible from an American perspective, but it might not be so from somebody else's perspective. One example I can think of is the Eat Local. I know it's not investing, but I'm sure there are parallels to Eat Local. It might be socially responsible to eat local from an American perspective, but if you think globally, Americans consume so much more energy per capita. It might be more, you know, you might...
So are we being too narrow, perhaps, in the definition if we only look at it through our individual lens or company lens?
I mean, I think that we were having a conversation about this before we all came out here, and we basically said, you know, we will evolve as an industry when we actually can get more specific, and that each of those values, whether it's here or in a specific emerging economy, actually can be reflected in individual portfolios. And so then people can basically say, you know, yes, that's what I care about, and we're transparent enough and specific enough that it can get reflected and it can be more broad. I think right now, since we're just evolving as an industry, unfortunately, things have, you know, sort of gotten, just fall under this big umbrella. But I think you're seeing more and more that companies, investors, investment firms are getting more specific and being a lot more transparent, so that we can get clarity around those definitions. And I, for one, think clarity is a really important thing, even if it means you have different levels of what it means because of where you are based regionally or what it means to that economy versus our economy. Because I do think incremental progress is still better, right, than not making any progress at all.
I'd just like to add one thing. I think... to your point, we have to be really careful about using a phrase to mean one single thing. So, for instance, how many Americans think that child labor is a bad thing and that we shouldn't invest in companies that have children in their workforce? Okay, nobody puts up their hand, but I expect most of you would if you were a little bit bolder. That's a rhetorical question. Okay. There are many companies that employ people we would consider to be children, and the children work half a day and are educated half a day. In those countries, in those places, that makes a huge impact, positive impact, on the income for their families and on those children's opportunity in life. Because the alternative for girls is prostitution and for boys is slave labor. You've got to be really careful about how you use the words and what you're trying to achieve.
Thank you.
So I have a question because I've recently had a bit of a change in perspective. I used to work as an investor, and now I work at a startup on the company side. And so I'm curious, what do you think companies can do to encourage more responsible investing and attract more responsible investing? What is their role in this?
I think that from the perspective of the conduit, especially to millennials, but a lot of other investors, is 401k programs. So what is it that the companies are asking, typically the representative that's coming in for their 401k program, that there are then X number of choices for employees? I think that is a huge question that companies can be asking. And so within that investment criteria, are those questions being raised so that then, and hopefully employees themselves are raising it. Because I think that what happens is people are put in the middle that may not have the background. But I think that's an important question for us. You know, we're all, if those working at companies ask themselves, or the employees of those companies ask. And I find more of those questions coming from millennials relative to the types of company they're working for. And hopefully it'll happen with their 401k plans, because we need them to invest in the 401k plans so they can have a voice to make the change.
And can I add one thing? I think public companies are required to report through public filings, should look at the SASB, the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board framework, and look at what they should be reporting, to, even if it's baby steps, to be putting the information about their performance on those measures out in the public domain.
So we have time for just one last question. So,
I'm David Riedel of Riedel Research. We do a lot of corporate governance scoring on companies in emerging markets, so we work with a lot of different markets around the world. And I want to just hear your thoughts on the role of regulators and exchanges in this, because we found in Brazil, for example, in Turkey, working with some people in Nigeria about some new initiatives there, I feel like the exchanges are being ignored as a really important part in making these changes.
So role of regulators and exchanges.
Last year I had the opportunity to do a corporate governance class at Berkeley, and that was one of the big surprises for me. You know, think about it, most economic models, we say once we get to the limits of economics, we go to the government. Then we go global capital markets, right? Most of my clients expect to be invested in emerging markets, all of them, you know, whatever's in the index, we're expected to be there. There's no world government. So how do we get, since there's no controlling force handling global governance or enforcing a global standard, you have a huge problem. Like a Lehman, they couldn't do Repo 105 in the U.S. It was illegal. So they went to London. They got a lawyer's letter from London. They call it jurisdictional arbitrage. Go where it's legal, do it there. So how do we get past that? And one of the things we discovered in this class was that the listing requirements have an outside influence. These exchanges, the New York Stock Exchange, Hong Kong, Alibaba listed in New York because it was more permissive than Hong Kong, I believe. And so you have these exchanges. Any rich person, any rich tycoon with a private company, ultimately will want to monetize that investment. They'll have to go to an exchange. So as you say, David, the exchanges have a real leadership role to play, and we as investors have a role to play in encouraging them to hold a high standard, because an exchange that isn't enforcing high governance standards is going to attract the wrong kind of companies and the wrong kind of investors.
Thank you for that perspective. You can see from the audience can see we are barely scratched the surface on this topic. We're actually very lucky that each of our panelists will be staying for the networking. So I know we can get through all the questions, and there's probably many seated. So I'd encourage everyone to come and enjoy the networking that's outside after the event. And again, ask your questions, but also ask each other. We actually have lots of different people in the audience that also are experts on this topic in addition to our great panelists. So I want to thank our panelists again for their time. Thank you, Preston, Michelle, Lloyd, and Gloria. Thank you for the evening. And again, if you're interested in becoming a member, we have guest services outside. Save for the reception. Happy holidays and happy networking, everyone. Thank you.